And that appears now to have happened. You may proceed.
Your Honor, this is an appeal from the district court dismissing a petition alleging breach of fiduciary duty by a senior executive of the Mid-City Bank. The Mid-City Bank failed and was taken into receivership by the FDIC as a result of James Fiddle's, frankly, criminal behavior. He made false statements on the records, he lied to the regulators, and he lied to his shareholders with whom he ordered duty. The FDIC did not file civil suit for the bank for over 4 years. The Fiddle heirs were named in a lawsuit by the Lindsay heirs. Lindsay heirs owned approximately a third of the value of the stock of the holding company that owned its sole asset, the bank. The Lindsays filed this suit, and it was held in abeyance to see what the FDIC would do. The FDIC may or may not have timely filed a lawsuit. By their own admission, they claim they filed on the last day. It is not clear to us that, in fact, they did timely file. Once that happened, the Lindsay shareholders amended the petition and moved to amend the petition so that they could allege a separate basis to keep jurisdiction in the district court. Now, there are two kinds. This is
Counsel, what's the separate basis that you're...
If you have a special relationship not shared by other shareholders, you can have a suit directly against management, the fiduciaries of the corporation.
Okay, but...
Otherwise, it would be derivative.
What's your theory of recovery, though?
They had a shareholder agreement and a separate fiduciary relationship for long standing. The senior Bill Lindsay, founded the Mid-City Bank with Mr. Phil. They were great friends. He told his family, always trust Mr. Fiddle. They had a shareholder agreement where they pledged to support Mr. Fiddle in the course of conduct in the bank.
So it would be a breach of the fiduciary, or the shareholder agreement?
Yes,
okay.
Your Honor.
How do you address the other party's claim in their brief that in none of your three complaints that were filed did you ever allege breach of shareholder agreement, nor do you in your fourth proposed one that you wanted to file? How do you address that?
Because we didn't need to, Your Honor. At that point, when we filed the first three as we went through it, it was no question that in the absence of the FDIC's action, the shareholders had every right to act. Now, there is federal precedent that states when the FDIC fails to act even effectively, shareholders can act on their own. So we have a separate argument that the FDIC, by literally letting it go by their own admission to the last day, if in fact they filed timely at all, that we have a right under some federal cases that say the shareholders, the Lindsay shareholders, can go forward. But beyond that, Your
Honor, did your theory morph, or were you from the beginning suing both directly and derivatively?
We were suing derivatively because of the lack of action of the FDIC, Your Honor. We had no need to allege a separate shareholder agreement because we had every right to in the absence of action by the FDIC. So the question really is, having filed that, having protected the rights not just of the Lindsay shareholders, but we were trying to protect all the shareholders.
Because it was, in your theory, initially derivative.
Yes, because the FDIC was not acting and it had been put into receivership. We are entitled under those circumstances under federal law to go forward with the suit directly by the
In the absence of an FDIC action.
Yes.
And then the FDIC filed something. And
on
what's
the last
that?
Day or maybe too
right.
late.
And then what does that do? Recast what you have?
Well, at that point, we can allege a different claim, which is the Lindsay shareholders alone have a separate fiduciary basis to sue the Fiddle estate and also...
Which rights will not be protected in the FDIC matter?
Yes, absolutely.
Is that critical to your thinking?
Yes, and let me explain why.
Well, Counsel, but why didn't you allege this breach of shareholder agreement in the proposed fourth one then?
I intended to, Your Honor. We weren't allowed to.
Well, no, you attached your proposed fourth to your motion to amend.
Right.
As part of the transcript... But nowhere in there do you mention breach of shareholder agreement.
Your Honor, we tried to plead that there was existing special relationship and there was a breach of the relationship. The shareholder agreement is simply the source of that. But there was also a separate fiduciary relationship given the nature of trust in, I mean, decades-long trust between the Lindsays and the Fiddles family. There's a separate fiduciary relationship that was there that is not there with any other shareholder. But we wanted to protect all shareholders, if we could, initially. Those are the points we have. I'll reserve the rest of the time if there are no more questions from the court. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So, Mr. Deegan. Good morning.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning to you.
Good morning. May it please the court. Mike Deegan, QTech Rock, on behalf of the appellee, the estate of James Fiddle. Of course, we're here on appeal from a motion to dismiss, and of course, this court has to take all of the facts as alleged below in the several complaints that were filed as true. I did want to address the opening comments of counsel relating to false statements and criminal activity. My client has subsequently passed away during the pendency of this action and is now in a position that he's no longer able to clear his name. That being neither here nor there, let me start by pointing out one of the fundamental problems with the appellant's case here, and that is they are shareholders in 304 Corporation. 304 Corporation is a separate entity from Mid-City Bank. Mid-City Bank, Inc. is also a Nebraska corporation. The appellants have no standing whatsoever to bring claims on behalf of the separate Mid-City Bank Corporation. It is a wholly owned subsidiary of 304 Corporation. But the juxtaposition that appellants have tried to navigate here is all of their allegations of harm and injury stem from the appellee's actions as an officer and director of Mid-City Bank Corporation, a corporation that the appellants have no interest in. They're not shareholders. They have absolutely no standing to raise any claim that is possessed by Mid-City Bank. Instead, they try to triangulate what initially, through several years of litigation, was a derivative claim on behalf of 304 Corporation. But then they magically step to the next step, that they have a derivative claim on behalf of the shareholders of 304 Corporation for the acts of an officer and director of 304 Corporation in his capacity as an officer and director.
What are the limitations of being a 304 corporation?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
What are the limitations of the 304 corporation?
What are the limitations?
Yeah, like shareholders and...
They are...
In other words, it's a form of business. What are the limitations?
It is a holding company. It is a holding company that was created for the purpose of essentially owning and operating Mid-City Bank. They had actually other assets. They owned some real estate assets and had some other operations, but clearly that was the principal purpose of 304.
So you have to look at the form of business.
You have to look at the form of the business, and I would agree with Your Honor, and we would not quibble with the fact that 304's primary purpose was to own the assets of the bank. But I don't think we can gloss over the fact that they are separate entities. They had separate boards of directors. They had separate officers. Some states have recognized...
Let me say, they had separate boards and separate officers, some of whom may have been on both?
That's correct. There was some intermingling of directors, and my client, the appellee, is one such individual.
But they attempted to maintain the separation during the course of whatever, the lifetime, the healthy lifetime of this enterprise?
Well, the as a regulated financial institution, Mid-City Bank is under a whole series of state and federal regulations regarding who can serve on that board of directors and who can serve as an officer of that bank. So there are very real reasons for maintaining that distinction. 304 Corporation, as a holding company, does not have those restrictions. So the officers, directors of the bank were subject to those regulations, and that's why that distinction was maintained.
You were going to mention some other courts, and then you didn't get to finish. What was your thought on that? Some other courts do what?
Yes, Your Honor. So the concept that we're talking about in the handful of states that have even recognized what's known as a double derivative action, that is where the shareholders of Company A bring a derivative action against or on behalf of Company A for injury and harm caused to a subsidiary corporation owned, operated, or controlled by Company A. So the shareholders of A bring an action on behalf of A for harms allegedly caused to the subsidiary corporation B below. And in those very few jurisdictions that have even recognized the availability of that relief, they recognize it's a very high standard. The shareholders would have to show first all the requisites of being able to bring derivative relief against the top-level corporation, Corporation A, and then they have to establish that there was a failure in A's direction to B that the subsidiary corporation refused to exercise. So in essence, it's almost equivalent to a legal malpractice case where you have to prove a case within a case. The plaintiffs would have to demonstrate that the board of directors in the company that they own an interest in failed to discharge their fiduciary duties in giving direction to B, and that B then failed in their own right to either exercise their own independent duties to their own company B, or in failing to implement directions that were imposed on them from the corporation A. Above.
Is there any explanation as to how this comes to be both a 304 and the bank as these separate entities when there's a number of folks who are on both? What's driving it and what is it to insulation from liability? Is it like a tax consequence of separating these things out and all the stuff that goes along with those different forms?
My understanding is it was driven by the regulatory requirements for the regulated bank, which was Mid-City Bank. So there are very strict requirements as to who can serve as a director.
There's less wiggle room on that side, but what about on the 304 side?
304, it was a family-owned corporation. It was owned by the Fiddle family.
So that's kind of looser.
Pardon?
Looser.
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. They were not subject to the regulatory requirements because that was not a regulated financial institution. That was a holding corporation that owned an interest in a financial institution.
This is the double derivative configuration.
That's correct.
It's not a tax thing. It's not like a... My double Dutch tax thing. This is a double derivative. That's all it is.
Yes. Okay. So not from a tax perspective, but right. From a corporate governance standpoint,
right.
That the shareholders, I think we just need to make clear that the appellants before this court did not have a direct financial interest in the bank. It's indirect. So we have this additional layer of complexity. But setting that level of complexity aside, we still have the very simple fact that, as we've heard counsel concede, and what he pled multiple times was a derivative action, and he failed to plead a proper derivative action. There is nothing in
counsel,
the record that...
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I got a question before your time runs out. What the judge dismissed this as or granted a motion to dismiss. That was how he ruled on it, correct?
Correct.
What effect in this case does it change that result that it really became a summary judgment because the affidavit received and the buy sell agreement was received, which would not be judicial notice, which is permitted, which you did at the start of the motion. So by the rules of pleading or rules under 1112B. It says it shall be treated as a summary judgment. So in reality, this is was a summary judgment case at that point. How does that change, if it does at all, the result of that of granting motions to dismiss?
I don't think it changes the result at all. I think the before the court failed to demonstrate any genuine issue of material fact that would sustain the derivative action that was before the court. The buy-sell agreement does not create a direct action. That is a buy-sell agreement between the shareholders of Real World Corporation, and all it governs is the sale of the transfer of the shares of Real World Corporation. It provides certain voting rights and certain rights to serve on the board of directors.
But that doesn't inform us on the issue.
It does not. But nowhere in that agreement is there any duty imposed on the employee for purposes of fiduciary duties or obligations with respect to the management of the underlying 304 corporation.
If this is a motion to dismiss,
dismiss. Is there any plausible way that the appellant could allege a cause of action?
No, Your Honor, because not only demonstrated by the multiple pleadings that they attempted, the other door slam here is the fact that the FDIC, in its capacity as a receiver, has brought an action to essentially assert these very claims.
Was it timely?
By statute. I'm sorry, Your
Honor. Was that action timely?
That action was timely. There have been, in fairness, that action has been saved pending some preliminary discovery for purposes of potential alternative dispute resolution. So there's not been an answer filed. But there's certainly been no adjudication that it was not timely filed. And it was filed on the last day of the statute agreement. But the federal cases that counsel alluded to is one case. It's the first Hartford case, and it is extremely distinguishable because in that instance, the claim being brought by the trustee was against the FDIC in its corporate capacity. So the federal court in that instance, they recognized an inherent conflict of interest that the FDIC had, and in that very limited circumstance, recognized an exception to allow the derivative action brought by the shareholders to go forward, notwithstanding the fact that the FDIC had already exercised its jurisdiction.
That's because the FDIC had a conflict of interest.
That's right. Okay. They were essentially suing themselves.
Right.
So seeing no more questions, for those reasons, we respectfully ask this court to affirm the decision of the district court.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? 4 minutes and 38 seconds, Mr. White. Thank you very much. The next case of the day is Sickler versus Sickler.